Hi everyone, it's Stu here, your dulcet-toned podcast host. Are you tired of ads interrupting your favourite true crime podcast? British Murders, of course. I mean, who needs a 60-second detour when you're in the midst of an immensely well-told story? The irony of this being an ad isn't lost on me, but I wanted to let you know that you can listen to British Murders completely ad-free by signing up for a Patreon membership. For as little as £3 per month, you'll get early access to ad-free episodes, as well as a heap of other benefits. I've got a fair few bonus episodes you can sink your teeth into, and every Monday I drop a new episode of the British Murders Weekly Journal. If you enjoy exclusive giveaways, my Patreon has those too. Head to patreon.com/britishmurders and choose either my OBE or KBE/DBE tier to rid yourself of those pesky adverts. Plus, you'll be helping support your favourite podcast so that I can offer you even more content going forward. I'd say that I'll shut up now, but you've got the rest of the episode to listen to. Back to you, Stu. This podcast contains elements that may be alarming to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
You are now listening to British Murders, the True Crime Podcast.
Right, there we go. We are recording. Nikki Perfect, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for your time. For my listeners that don't know who you are, they will after the end of this chat, but do you want to just give yourself a bit of an introduction, maybe sum up your illustrious career in three sentences?
In three sentences? Oh, wow, that's amazing. Gosh. Yeah, so I am a former police officer. Last decade of my 31-year service was as an international hostage and crisis negotiator. And I've now turned international trainer consultant, and I help people to use the skills that I learned as a negotiator in sort of everyday difficult conversations, really.
So cool. I've been stalking you, really, looking at your various websites. So there's nikkiperfect.com.
There is, and yeah.
The communicationcoach.co.uk. Yeah. Any other websites that I've missed?
No, just those two. It's like you've somehow along the way you have to like use your surname, don't you? Come on, like if I have the surname Perfect, there's no point in not using it anywhere. But I only did the nikkiperfect.com after the book was launched, just as somebody said, oh, you need to have a website in your name before kind of anybody else does it. And I was like, why would anybody else have a website in my name? That's weird. But of course people do. And then it was an easier place to send people for the book.
It kind of makes more sense, doesn't it, as a tie-in to the book. So I was going to ask, and it's probably a daft question that you've been asked a million times, is Perfect your actual surname?
Yes. So Perfect is my real surname. As my dad always said to my mum, he was born Perfect, and she only became it when she met and married him.
I love that. That's so cool. So tell me about your time in the police before we get into the hostage stuff. So you started in the late 80s. Now, my maths figures out that you started in about 1988. Is that right?
Yeah, so I joined when I was a police cadet at the very tender age of 18 in 1986. You were just off. You were very close. Yeah, so 1986, and I became like a regular police officer in 1988. So I did a year as a cadet and then became a regular police officer in 88.
So what force was that with?
That was with the Metropolitan Police in London.
Straight with the Met. So when you're first a cadet then and you're 18, you're very young, what prompted you to follow that career path?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because I wouldn't have told you that I'd always wanted to be a police officer, because it wasn't that case. I knew I liked sport and I knew I liked people. So in my head, as I was reaching that time when I was doing my A-levels. So I got five GCSEs and was looking to do A-levels. And my dad very wisely realised I wasn't going to be an academic in any way, shape or form or go to university. It just wasn't me. School for me was a social event. I went for sport, music and chatting, really, if I'm honest. And I really enjoyed school. You know, it wasn't a problem going because I really enjoyed it. So I was at that stage, you know, where people start, oh, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? So I was like, well, I'll either be a sports teacher because I love sport, or I will be a police officer because I like people and that seems to be okay. And my dad saw an advert in the newspaper that he reads, and it was an advert for the police cadets, and it showed all these young people doing great things like abseiling, canoeing, rock climbing, having fun, laughing, joking. And he said, do you fancy this? And I was like, yes, that would be amazing. So we went to the careers department at Scotland Yard, as it was then, and they showed me videos of people doing these amazing things and told me that I would get paid and that I'd stand a good chance of getting in because I was from London. And I was like, yeah, this is amazing. This looks great. And that's what I did. And I became successful. And on the 5th of December in 1986, my parents dropped me off at the gates of Hendon. And that's where I stayed for the next 31 years, not at Hendon, but within that environment for 31 years. Yeah. And I honestly loved it. It was such a variety because there's so many different jobs within policing that you can do. So you don't have to sit still in the same job. You can train, you can do all sorts of things. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Did you have an idea of which of those sort of forks you wanted to take within policing? Did you know what role, or was it a case of perhaps you wanted to try different things? What was your thought process?
Yeah, so initially when I joined policing, they used to be called home beats then in the good old bad old days, as people would say. So they used to be called home beat officers. They're now called neighbourhood police officers. And I really like the idea of that because that you got to know your community really well. Everybody knew you. You knew everybody. You knew what was going on. So I thought that that's what I wanted to do. And then I joined policing and I just loved being a street police officer. I loved the variety of it. I loved not knowing what was going to happen next. I loved the fact that you could talk to people. I remember, you know, just in the 80s, we had more police officers on the street and we had more time to do policing. And so, for example, I went to visit a guy who'd been burgled and he'd lost his wife not long before. So I ended up going and spending a couple of hours with him on Christmas Day because I was at work on early turn. So me and my colleague, my friend, we popped round just to make sure he was okay. And we stayed for a while with him. And that was the sort of aspect of policing I really enjoyed, being with people. And then I realised that there was an opportunity to drive fast cars. So I thought that looks like fun as well. So then I became an advanced driver. So, yeah, so no, in answer to your question, no, I had no plans when I joined policing other than perhaps I might do promotion at some stage. Didn't really know what it was about. I was still, you know, I came from London, seen some things, but not really seen anything. So there were many jobs within policing that I didn't even knew existed until you spoke to somebody and they went, oh, I've done this. And you're like, oh, I didn't know you could do that. How do you apply for that kind of thing? So yeah, I had no structure at all. I just kind of fell into stuff.
It's weird because when I've spoke to former officers, like I've had Jackie Moulton on, who you might have potentially worked with, yeah? And I think she also did the driving course. It seems to be a sort of idea that people flirt with once they know what it is. But it seems quite similar, and I'm not comparing them at all because they're vastly different, but I've worked in an office environment, right? And it's similar where there's roles within the industry that you don't know exist, and it's only upon hearing it in passing, maybe, you know, you grab a coffee or something, you hear someone, oh, have you heard about the vacancy at so-and-so? Do you think that's strange though, within a department such as the police, where there's so many roles that people just aren't aware exist? You'd think people would know everything, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but it's when you're at your station, so you know, the Met is huge. It's a huge machine. And when you're at your station, so I started my policing career at Catford in Southeast London, and then I went to Sydenham shortly afterwards. And that's all that was my world, was policing Catford and Sydenham. So I knew things that related immediately to me. So I knew of the territorial support group because I got seconded to football matches. So Millwall was just down the road. So I did a lot of policing at Millwall. So I knew what they did. I knew that there was the mounted branch because I'd seen them about. And so they had an impact on my life if I saw them. I knew there were firearms officers. Although when I first joined, we didn't have very many firearms officers. And those that were trained had to go and book their gun out of the safe at the police station if something was happening, and there was one car patrolling London. Obviously that increased. So I was aware of those immediate things. I was aware that there was a CID at Catford. I was aware that there were squads, different, like, you know, robbery squads and all of those, but they were all very localized, And then you'd hear of these other squads that existed, but they were never on my frame. So I kind of never really thought anything about them. The only one I started to think about was the territorial support group, because that felt for me, because I was a uniformed officer, that felt like the next progression. That was something different. You were responsible for the whole of Southeast area rather than just your little local police station. And so that was kind of the natural progression for me as a uniformed officer. But certainly for people like Jackie, because she was in the CID, the progression would have been to go into a squad and then maybe a squad and then maybe the main CID and then look at more centralized units. So yeah. But yeah, it is interesting because you don't know what you don't know, do you? And so sometimes you learn on opportunities just because you don't know.
Well, that's it. I suppose when you're concentrated on what your role is, then any other roles aren't really they're outside your remit, aren't they, really? So it's not worth focusing on them. I'm curious to find out if you've felt there are any barriers sort of being in the force as a woman in that time. Were there anything that frustrated you, any major differences between you and the men officers?
So the major thing that frustrated me was I couldn't wear trousers when I first joined police. And so that was, I'm just not a skirts person. I'd never have been. And they kind of just got in the way with my little handbag that you had to carry. So that was my biggest frustration. Honestly, was not being able to wear trousers. When I went to Sydenham, I was really lucky because there was the team that I was on, we had a lot of females and we had a lot of experienced females. So they kind of took me under their wing and really nurtured me and looked after me. There were some things like I wanted a posting on the area car. So the area car was the car that got all the good calls, the fast car, and that was like a plum posting to have. And I remember having conversations with both advanced drivers driving the area car, just a couple, and members of their family, and saying, well, I don't want you on the car because you're not going to be strong enough to be able to do this. You're not going to be able to do that. You're not going to be able to do this. And I remember thinking, okay, so I might not be physically as strong as you, but I have different skills that I can bring. I can talk to people. I can listen to people. I can do different things. So they were the main frustrations. I didn't feel that it hindered me at that stage. Well, actually, I didn't feel that it hindered me at any stage. I've always been very aware that, you know, when you look around, it's always a table full or a bus full or a crew full of guys. But as I say, when I was at Sydenham especially, we had some strong women, some really good, strong women on that team that really helped me out.
Have you noticed any changes to that over the last 30 years? So at what point have you thought, oh, we're actually making some progression here, if at all?
Yeah, so I think the first progression was we were allowed to wear trousers, which was actually huge in those days.
When was that? Can you remember?
So that must have been, I was at 88, it must have been 1990, 91, so the early 90s. At the time, you still were, if a female was arrested and they had a child, you were always called back to the station to go and look after the child. But things started changing because I remember having a conversation as I got a bit more confident myself and saying to the person that called me back in, saying to them, sorry, how many children do you have? And they were like, three. And I was like, well, I don't have any. So it would make more sense for you to look after the children because you've got far more experience. So things like that started to change, and because attitudes started to change. So suddenly you were doing the same roles as men were. And only a few years before I joined, they weren't. They were like the station officer. Well, females left quite early on in their careers. There was always a saying that most female officers got married within 5 years and then they would leave policing. But times, my generation, definitely, we were like, no, this is a career for us. This is, we want to be doing everything that we possibly can. We want to be enjoying it. And so the attitudes were changing anyway with the different generation that was coming in and has changed again and again and again.
It's constantly changing from what I can see. Looking back on that 20 years then, we'll come on to the hostage stuff soon. Apart from that lovely story about spending Christmas at that gentleman's house, which is nice. If you are asked, let's say you're at a party and you tell people what you did and they say, oh, what's sort of your go-to story about that time in policing? It could be something a scene you've attended. It could be something that happened in the office. What's like your most memorable story from that time?
I think my most memorable story from that time is that we had a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun. So my life was either being at work or being with my colleagues. It was a huge drinking culture then. So we would either be at work, in the pub, or doing something together. So it was a real family unit, especially on that frontline policing team. Some of the things I remember from those early days, you would always be out walking on your own. I remember going to Catford Shopping Centre. I was talking to somebody the other day, actually, who lives and works in Catford, when I was talking about the black cat and the poverty in Catford. And in Catford Shopping Centre, I was just doing my normal patrol and I saw a guy breaking into a shop, a flower shop. I chased him. Unfortunately, we lost him. But next day, the owners of the shop sent me a bunch of flowers just to say, thank you for doing that. So that sticks it. That always sticks in my mind. We used to do, times have changed so much, but we used to do a school crossing patrol. So you used to go, if the lollipop lady didn't turn up, you would go and do the school crossing patrol. So you'd get to speak to all the kids. So that, you know, that was nice. Although I have to say, like, when you were sat down on parade and the sergeant was reading out what you were being posted to, you always knew if you were the youngest in service. So I would often get school crossing patrol because the senior officers would never get that. So it was quite... But that was okay. You learn to talk to people and listen to people, which was great. Getting my advanced course, that was really cool. I really enjoyed doing that, advanced driving. Definitely, I remember the stabbing of the sergeant in New Addington, and that's when things started to change, I think. Well, that's when I felt a bit of a shift, because before then, we didn't have a stab-proof vest or MET vest or anything like that. And that was a sudden shift in, hang on a sec, how are we protecting ourselves? And then I think there was more of a rise in violence. So there was physical assaults, but there was a code of conduct. I remember sitting in the van with an old school criminal who was being arrested, and he knew he was going to go back to prison. But even he was saying things like, you know, I'd never hit a woman. These youngsters, they've got no decorum around respect. There's certain things that you wouldn't do. So, you know, so there was a code of conduct within criminality, certainly in the southeast of London. You know, it was not long after the eras of the Crays and the Richardsons. And so there was this code of conduct about not hitting women, being respectful for police officers, even if they were coming after you. And gradually over the late 80s, early 90s, there started to be a shift, started to be a change, more knife crime, certainly to start with, and then more gun crime. Police officers never used to get threatened with guns, or if they did, it was very rare. They didn't really get shot at. And then we went for a period where suddenly that all changed. There was more guns on the street. There was more people using violence against police officers. And then before you knew it, that wasn't even news. So it had become the norm over the years. So, yeah.
It's frightening, isn't it, how years gone by, there was such a respect and almost to a point, a fear of police officers, you know, the fear of being reprimanded, being arrested, that just does not seem to exist anymore. You'll see kids on the street and they just do whatever they want. There's no fear of repercussions. We don't have the cops on the street now, but it's a completely different time. What's your thoughts on how current policing standards are, just in relation to sort of the amount of crime that's going on, especially knife crime, which has just gone up and up and up and up and up? How do you think it is now versus when you were there?
Yeah, there was definitely more police officers on the street. So we would sit on a parade and we would parade, you know, between 20 and 30 people for our area. So everybody had a task and a space to patrol. But there was also the home beat officer, and everybody, honestly, everybody knew them. So if you stopped anybody in the street, so Fred was our local one. People would say, how's Fred? Oh, can you ask Fred to pop around and see me? Or I'd go, Fred, there's been a burglary. He said, well, what's the method? And I said, oh, they've taken out the window frame. Oh, I think it might be so-and-so. Let me just make some inquiries about what they're doing. So they knew absolutely everybody, and they had the time to go and speak to people. You don't get that anymore. You have police officers that are run ragged, running from call to call, really reactive, not enough of them on the streets, in my opinion. But then you also don't have the experience. So your most experienced person on team now will be like 3 years service. When I joined team, we had people of 15, 20 years service. And that experience really helps, because when you're learning the job and you're looking for your role models and you're looking to, you know, policing's all about people. It's all about human connection and human relationships. And that doesn't matter whether you're arresting somebody or you're going around to give a death message. It's all about people and their emotions. But when you don't have time to speak to people, time to build those relationships within the community, then there becomes a breakdown because people don't know you. So why would somebody come and speak to me about information about so-and-so down the road when they've never met me and they've never seen me? But whereas if they know and see Fred every single day and he goes to all their community events and they trust him, because trust is a huge thing, then they're more likely to go and speak to Fred about something and say, Fred, I'm not sure about this. Can we just have a chat? And you've got that trust there. So it's hard for police officers, I feel, to build relationships with the community and get that trust at the moment, because there's not enough of them and there's not enough of them being in single spots and places where people can just go, oh, I'm going to speak to Fred about this.
Yeah. The key word I picked up on there was reactive.
Yeah.
Which sort of ties in with the stabbing story that you mentioned. So it wasn't until someone got stabbed that the idea was we need stab vests. And it seems reactive rather than proactive. But do you think population comes into that? Because back, you know, two decades ago, the population was a lot less than what it is now. The communities now are far larger. And the community spirit seems to have disappeared. Like we have neighbours, we never speak to them. We live on a cul-de-sac. I don't know pretty much 90% of my neighbours. So that community spirit seems to have gone. But again, we've never seen a policeman walk in the streets, a policewoman, whatever. Do you think the population and the culture is a factor?
Yeah, it could be, especially in, I live in a little village, so I know everybody and everybody knows me. And that's one of the reasons I moved from London to a little village, is because it's that community. I think you get pockets of it. So you get pockets of community within communities, like church, for example. If you're a churchgoer, you've probably got a community there. If your kids go to a club, you've probably got a little community there. Or maybe you go to a club yourself, so you'll have a little community there. Maybe even just going to the gym, you might have a community. But I appreciate what you're saying, you know, our everyday conversations. And I also wonder if our lifestyles have changed, because we're all so busy. We're so busy. It's like, I've got to focus on, right, I need to get to where I've got to get to. I've got so much going on in my head. Like, who's dropping the kids off? We had that conversation. Someone, who's dropping the kids off? Who's picking the kids up? Who's making lunch? Where do I have to be? And emails. Honestly, I can wake up to 150, 200 emails. When I was at work and I had a little tray, I didn't wake up to 200 pieces of paper in my tray. That never happened. So technology is great, and it's also not so great. I always feel there's an upside of every downside, and there's a downside of every upside. I feel that most of us are good people, and I witness this in London all the time. On the tube, I don't know if you've ever taken the tube in London. It's a very special place where people don't talk to each other at all, unless something happens. And then they do. They all pull together and they all look out for each other. But until that time, you wouldn't have a conversation.
I think it's the same. I mean, I've been on the tube. It's the same up here. You'll go on the train and everyone's got their headphones in. But then again, I think the way things are now, if you did just start talking to someone, they'd think you're just really strange, which is bizarre. But the technology thing's interesting, because people have communities online now. And like you said, with the emails, there's so much ease of access. There's too much access, really. So you could have 150 emails, 80% might be nonsense or spam, or someone's just found your email somewhere and wants to sell you something. So you're not going to get the 10 sheets of paper that are meaningful, you know? It's all just a lot of it's spam. Maybe that's just me. But let's talk about your career then as a hostage negotiator. So the reason why I sort of reached out to your publisher, HQ, was because of the book that came out in August. So it's called Crisis, True Stories of My Life as a Hostage Negotiator. And it was in, let's have a look where we came, 2008. When you became a hostage and crisis negotiator and you attended this 2-week incredibly intensive course, you said, in December, yeah. Which turned your world upside down. So before we go on to how it turned your world upside down, how has this opportunity come about?
Yeah. And this is what I love about conversation and communication, is because people always talk about communication as a soft skill. And I always say, no, it's a life-changing, life-saving skill. And one of the reasons is because if you think about different times in your life where there's been a pivot and a change, for better or worse, it's generally because of a conversation. So this is how my change of life happened. I was working on the firearms team. So I was one of 7 women out of 650 men at the time. I was an inspector, and I was leading a team of 43 men across the whole of London. So responsible for 24-hour armed response vehicles. I'd never been a firearms officer before. I was fairly new as an inspector, but I wanted a challenge, a new challenge, a different challenge. And so an opportunity came up, a vacancy arose. So I applied for it and I managed to get it. And whilst I was there, I'd been there for a couple of years, and I was finding it hard. I refer to it in the book as feeling like a piece of jigsaw, whereby you kind of fit, but you don't really fit. You know, those pieces that, like the sky, it's always the sky, you know, you've got these bits left over and it looks like it should fit, and you're pressing it down.
Like a millimetre off.
That's right, yeah. It looks like it should fit, but it doesn't quite fit, and you're pressing it down, pressing it down. Well, that's how I felt on the firearms unit. I felt that I should fit, but I didn't quite fit. And there was, in hindsight and reflection, there's a lot of reasons why that was. A lot to do with me, a lot to do with my naivety as an inspector, being the only female there, not really having any role models female wise to look after and be able to talk to. And then my mentor joined. So she wasn't mentor at the time. She's called Liz in the book, and she joined, and she was a superintendent, so she was a couple of ranks above me, and she became my mentor and somebody that I could go and speak to whilst I was there on the firearms unit. And she was one of these people, I don't know if you've ever had this, but when I left the room from talking with her, I felt like the most important person in the world at that time. And that is a huge skill. Not many people are able to do that. And I kept thinking, oh, what is it? What is it? Why? How does she manage to do that? Of course, I found out later that she was a negotiator. And so she was just giving me a really good listening to and using her negotiation skills. And she said to me, have you ever thought about being a negotiator? We were just talking about career progression and the future and what it looked like. And I said, I thought you had to be a chief inspector, because at the time in the Met, you had to be a chief inspector to become a negotiator. She said, no, they changed the rules this year. You have to be an inspector. She said, I think you'd be good at it. I think you'd enjoy it. You've got the right skills for it. So I started to find out a little bit more about it. I spoke to more people that I knew about negotiation. I was like, yeah, this sounds amazing. I'd really like to give it a go. Now, in the Met, it only comes out once a year, or did at the time, comes out once a year in the autumn. And I then left firearms policing. Liz was still my mentor, and I went to work for the Professional Standards Unit, which was the investigating internal complaints and misconduct and things like that. So I was working there, and the application form came out, and I applied for it. And I got it. It's quite a drawn out process. You have to do an application form, then you have to have an interview, and then you have to do a role play. And I got through it, and it took nearly a year for me to get onto my course. So I applied for it in October, November 2007, and December 2008, I finally got on my course. So that was how I ended up becoming a negotiator, or applying to become a negotiator.
So what was so intensive then about this course? It's 2 weeks, which is pretty short based on the role you went on to do. Why was it so crammed into such a short space of time, and what did it consist of?
So the two-week course, I call it an intensive two-week course because I've done firearms courses and they were intense, you know, over periods of time. I've done driving courses. They were intense. I was a SOET officer, which is a sexual offences investigative techniques officer. So I'd done all of those courses. So I wasn't, and I actually thought I was quite a good communicator, if I'm honest with you, Stuart. So I turn up on this course thinking this will be great. I'm really looking forward to this. And suddenly everything I said, how I said it, what was my thought process behind what I was saying was not challenged, but I was asked the question, what made you say that? Oh, hang on a sec. I don't know.
What was the negotiator here? Is it me or is it you?
Yeah. What did I say? Why did I say that? And what that, I call it a personal development course, not just a negotiation course, because it, what it did was it made me look at my belief system. It made me look at my value system. And it made me realize that every conversation I have is all about me, really. I didn't learn all of that in 2 weeks. Obviously, it's been a long, gradual process, and I'm still learning. But it started me questioning, okay, hang on a sec, what is making me say that, and who's that about? Oh, yeah, that's all about me. Well, it can't be all about me, because there's somebody there whose life needs saving. So I have to park that. I have to park my thoughts and my judgments and put them over here. And now I'm aware of them. And well, where do they come from? Why am I even thinking that way? And so for me, it turned everything I believe to be true kind of on its head, because we communicate in a really unconscious way most of the time. We just say things. And it's not until we have a challenging conversation or a critical conversation or a life-saving conversation that we have to stop and go, hang on a sec, I need to be really conscious here. I need to think about the words that I'm using. I really need to be present, and I really need to listen to what that other person is saying to find out what they're telling me, but also what they're not telling me. The course was really long, so it was 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. in the classroom, and then you'd have your like dinner break, 5 to 6, and then from 6 o'clock till sometimes 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, you'd be in role play and you'd be debriefing that role play. So you were put under immense pressure. And you were exhausted deliberately, because most people are in crisis, you know, like at 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, not at 4, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And so they wanted to be sure that when you left there, that you were ready to go out and to speak to people in life-changing and life-saving circumstances. Now, that 2 week is the beginning as a negotiator. You then have a choice. You can either say, well, I've had my 2 week course and that's fine, or like me, I became really obsessed with it and I was like, this is amazing, this is what I want to do for the rest of my career, probably the rest of my life. I want to know more about psychology, communication, human behavior. And I became like this sponge absorbing all this information, and just that's all I wanted to do, put myself on call all of the time. So in the UK, most negotiators they do it on top of their day job. So I had my day job in professional standards, and then I would put myself on call. And there was a core team of 6 people who worked out of New Scotland Yard, and they were full-time negotiators, and they were responsible for doing all the training, working with Her Majesty's government, and looking after London negotiators and the response to negotiation. And I was like, I want to be on that team. I really want to be on that team. Not only did I really want to be on that team, but I really want to be part of this training environment, because this has had such an impact on my life. I want to be able to take that and share that with other people and make a difference in other people's lives. And so 5 years later, there was an opportunity to apply for the full-time unit, which I did, and I managed to get onto it, which was amazing. And then spent the last 6 years of my career doing that full-time, and became the director of the UK training in 2013, which was, again, a real privilege and an honour to be able to do that. It was just, just the best job I've ever had.
The story will continue after these quick messages. And now, back to the story.
It makes sense the way you've described it, that 2 week course, because like you say, what's the odds that you're going to be fully rested, midday, called to a crisis and fully able to prepare for it? You're far more likely to get called out of bed 2 in the morning, aren't you, for it? So can you remember the first situation you were called to then that needed you to use your skills? Tell me that.
Yeah, I can recall it really clearly. It was, so I was on call and, no, I wasn't on call. I'd been on call before and I hadn't managed to have a job, and I was desperate to use these new skills. You know, I thought that my 2 week course, I was going to be able to save and change the world forever, as you do when you have a course that you become passionate about, or a new skill. And I wasn't on call, and my phone rang, and it was about 10:30, 10:45 at night. And I remember getting really excited, because in the middle of my phone was the name Steve. And Steve had been one of the people that had taught me how to be a negotiator initially. And I knew there was only one reason why Steve was phoning me. So I answered the phone really, you know, over eagerly, like a puppy. And I'm like, "Hi, Steve, how can I help you?" And he's like, "Hi, Nick." Really calm and casual. And I'm like, oh gosh, heart pounding, you know, all those sorts of things that happen when you get overexcited. And he said, "Look, I know you're not on call, but there's an incident about 10 minutes from where you live. Can you go?" I said, "Gosh, yeah, of course I can. Not a problem." And I didn't, you know, not even thinking about the next day or who would cover my role in my normal work or anything like that. Everything just went by the wayside. He said, right, so there's a guy, he's been released from prison fairly recently. He was inside for grievous bodily harm. He's gone round to his ex-partner's house. They've had an altercation. She's alleged that he has assaulted her and he's taken the child. So he had this child with this lady before he went to prison, and the child was about 2 to 3 months old, and he'd never seen the child before. So he's taken the child without her permission. She's phoned 999. There's been a car chase around South London where he's failed to stop for police. And they finally have managed to like sting the car. You might have seen it on the 999 programs where they throw the stinger across the road, it punches the tires, and the car comes to a stop. And he's now surrounded by police officers. When I get there, I just remember that he was huge. He filled the whole car, and the child was tiny. He almost like held the child in one hand. Now, for me to get to that call, I had to wait for a fast car. And I remember all these things going through my head about how amazing this was going to be. I was going to go and save the day. He was going to listen to me. I was going to listen to him. We were going to have a great conversation. He was going to hand me the child, shake me by the hand, and off we'd go. And of course, none of that happened. I arrived. I spoke to him for about 8 hours. He said 2 things to me. One I can't repeat, but the other one was, "You don't understand. You don't understand." And he ended up being tasered. The child was safe and fine and well. We got her back okay, but he ended up being tasered and being arrested. Not in that lovely, "Here you are, I'll be handcuffed," coming out the car, but in, you know, there was a fight. And I walked away from that feeling really flat and deflated and thinking, gosh, I've been given these new skills. I can't even use them. What's happened? How did that happen? And I spent many an hour reflecting on that. And still think about that a lot, and have more experience now, more knowledge. And then it suddenly dawned on me, and I was like, hang on, that whole conversation, that whole incident was all about me and about how amazing I was going to be and about all these belief systems that I held about, you know, I've got these great new skills, I'm going to save the world, we're going to become friends, he's going to hand me the child, we're going to have a lovely conversation. You know, he didn't see any of that. He probably saw, although I'm guessing because I've never spoken to him since, but he probably saw this white middle-aged woman walking towards him and thought, well, how on earth are you going to help me? You're with them. You want to take my child away and send me back to a place I don't want to go. And I never saw that. I never took that moment to stop and go, what does the world look like through your lens? What's the world look like from your perspective? And once I realized how to do that, conversations and negotiation became a lot easier. But yeah, so I learned a lot from that first negotiation. I'll always remember it.
So for that 8 hours then, he's saying 2 things.
Yeah.
What are you talking the whole time, or are the periods where you're just waiting it out? Just talk me through from arriving at the scene, because in the films, right, I know it's mainly like big buildings, diehard hostage situations. You don't think of people threatening to end their own lives and stuff, which I'm assuming you'd get brought in for also. I'm guessing you don't arrive on the scene like, you know, Rocky Balboa walking down and, you know, here comes the champion kind of thing. Just talk me through what happens from your arrival there and then over the course of that 8 hours, what's actually happening?
So on arrival, you get a briefing. So the incident is run by a incident commander, who is normally a sergeant or inspector at the local police station. So they have overall responsibility. As a negotiator, I am just a resource to that incident commander. So they make all the big decisions. They carry the burden of, if it all goes wrong, I have to make sure I've done everything right. But also the joy of, if it all goes well, that'd be great. So negotiators are just an option. So I arrived on scene. I had a briefing with the incident commander, and there were also the negotiator coordinator. So in negotiation, you have a negotiation coordinator who's responsible for looking after the team and taking the initial call and making the decision who to deploy and how many people and what that looks like. And they are also the person that links in with the incident commander. So they stay with them and tell them what's happening. They're also the person that sets the strategy. And so then I get my strategy from my coordinator, who will say, you know, this is what I want you to try and achieve. So just getting most of the time, it's just getting people to talk because they don't want to talk to you. The majority of the time in police negotiations, people do not want to talk to you. So they don't, you don't just turn up and they suddenly start offloading everything. You have to build a relationship with people. But in any negotiation, in anything that you do, from talking to your kids, trying to get them to bed, to having a negotiation with your partner about Christmas, which we're recording this in December, so that's always important. It's always about building relationships and getting people to a point where they trust what you're going to say, they trust what you're going to suggest. So I then went, I had another negotiator with me, and we went and started trying to engage. I was the person that was doing the talking. The other person was there to help with the listening and to sort of, when nothing's happening and you bounce ideas off each other. So they're like the friend to the lead person, the coach to the lead person. So it was raining. I remember it was raining hard and all the experienced negotiators had great big golfing umbrellas. I remember thinking, yeah, note number one, always take an umbrella. But during the time, you don't even remember that it's raining or that it's cold or anything like that. You're so focused on what you're doing and what your role is. So I'm trying, my first job is to try and get him to engage with me, just anything, just even look at me, because he's not even looking at me. He's holding the child and he's ignoring everything that is happening around him. So I should imagine, knowing more about human behavior, that he would just had a lot of thought process. He was probably in fight, flight or freeze, didn't really know what to do, found himself in a situation that he hadn't planned for. Here he was surrounded by police. So he have had a lot of emotional thoughts going on. Don't want to go back to prison, all those sorts of things. So I'm fighting against that, his internal dialogue and what's going through his head without really even knowing that. So just trying to engage him, trying to get him to look at me, trying to get him to wind the window down, try and get him to start thinking about the situation we're in and what's going to happen next. And that took a long time. It takes a long time. I remember, like, after 3 or 4 hours, he wound the window down that much, you know, just so that, and I was like, well, that's a breakthrough, you know, he's on the window down. So that's good. So just being there and keeping talking to him and sort of trying to get a response, trying to work out what might be happening for him. Yeah. And that, you know, just being told to go away in the politest of terms to start with. And then, you know, you don't understand. And when I reflect back, I'm thinking, well, actually, you're right. I probably don't understand, really, because I've never lived your life. I don't know what it's like to be you. So, yeah, very. So, and then during the time, as the time goes on, there'll be the incident commander and the negotiation coordinator will be talking about tactics and plans for the future. And then you might go and have a meeting with them and have a conversation with them. And they'll be saying, like, well, can you try this next? Or this is what we want you to do next. So there's lots going on in the background that you're not privy to, because if you're given too much information, that might then show on the conversation that I'm having with you. Yeah, your role is just to engage them and keep them safe, really, and get the safe release of the child.
What would you do differently if you could go back now, knowing what you know with your experience? What would you do differently?
I'd talk to him in a very different way. So if that scenario were to happen again, I would probably just say it as I saw it and go up to him now and say, do you know what? You probably are looking at me and thinking, what on earth is a white middle-aged woman going to have in common with me? And that I'm here to take your child away from you and send you back to a place you don't want to go. Now, I don't know that to be true, but I'm guessing that, because that's probably how I would feel if I were you. And he might not reply, but at least now I've shown that I'm trying to see the world from his perspective.
Yeah, you're sort of saying, there's a good chance there that you are saying what he's thinking, right?
Which, yeah, kind absolutely.
Of, I guess that breaks down a barrier. Do you have a go-to set of questions that you will typically ask when you arrive on a scene? Or is it literally a case of seeing what's going on first and then adapting what you're going to ask?
Yeah, it's totally the second one. So you always plan in a negotiation. And I always say, if you've got a difficult conversation coming up in your life, think about it before you go straight in, because it just allows your emotional brain to settle down and you can start to think about what you're going to say. So don't have a set of questions to go to. Big open questions, you know, like the what, where, when, how, who, why, where are always great to start any conversation, because you get more from the other. Those big open questions, as you probably know, are designed to get more than a yes, no response. So you want to start there. In any relationship you're building, big open questions are always where you're going to start. And then you just literally adapt to what you've got in front of you. Because some people will engage with you fairly soon afterwards, and you can, and some people just want to talk, you know. Some people have never been given a good listening to. That's what I always say, give them a good listening to, and people always laugh. But actually, when we are listened to, it helps us to feel valued and validated and to have a place in the world. And many times in our lives, we just want to be listened to. We don't want people to give us advice. We don't want them to solve our problem. We don't want them to tell us how we should do it or that we need to do this. We just want someone to listen to us, because we can often see a different path when somebody does that. So, yeah, so no set. You have to have quite an adaptive brain. You have to be quite quick on your feet about thinking outside the box and go with what you've got in front of you.
That leads on to a question one of my patron members asked. This is from Karen. So Karen said, what would you say are three core skills a negotiator must have?
Yeah, great question, Karen. So three core skills. First one is the ability to listen, but really listen, not just half-heartedly listen. So the ability to switch everything else off in your brain and be in that moment, in that present moment with the other person. So I'd say that one. And that sounds so easy. And when people say to me, I've got a really difficult conversation coming up, what would you suggest? And I go, listen to the other person. And they're like, that's easy. I always do that. And I'm like, hang on. Let's rewind that. Because it's actually a really hard thing to do, is to stop that unconscious brain kicking in, and that judgment brain kicking in, is to just quieten that down and go, right, I'm ignoring all of this. This is you are my focus, and nothing else matters for this period of time. So that's the first one, to be able to really listen, actively listen and be present. The second one is patience, because sometimes you will make judgments about other people, and sometimes they will say things and do things that are completely against what you believe to be true and what your opinion is. And sometimes they will even challenge your opinion, and it can feel like you're being challenged. So having the patience to stay non-emotional, very logical, and thinking of it factually rather than bringing your own emotions into it. And the third one I would say is resilience, because like that first negotiation, that was 8 hours. I've been on negotiations that have taken 13 hours before. I've been on international negotiations that have taken 6 months to a year. So having the patience having the resilience when things don't go your way, when you don't get the response that you want to get, whether that's from the other person or from somebody else making the decisions. So as a negotiator, I would often be negotiating with the person in front of me, but also when I became a negotiator coordinator, I'd be often negotiating with people who are making the decisions. So, yeah, and in your lives, that could be you're having a negotiation with a member of your team, but then actually your boss is making a different decision, or you're having a negotiation with your child, but then your partner is making a different decision. So you end up negotiating with all parties. So that's resilience as well, yeah. Listening, patience, resilience, definitely.
The listening one's interesting, because people have a tendency to be so concerned about what their follow-up question is that they don't listen to the answer of the question, which is interesting. So if you've got a set of questions prepared, and I'm not talking about interviews, I'm talking you could confront, say, your partner about what you're going to do that weekend. You might say, what about this, this, and this? If you don't listen to the answer, you can't adapt to the conversation. You're just going to worm it back to question two. And I think active listening, I mean, working in a call center, I think has helped me with that. It's just like, you really have to listen, because you've got a pissed off customer at the end of the phone line there. I'm curious about how much information you give about yourself. Is that something that's frowned upon, or is that something you would use as a tactic?
That's a great question, because the tendency is to talk about yourself. We like to talk about ourselves. And that's fine. It's just about knowing. None of this, like not listening, being unconscious, being judgmental, none of this is wrong. It's about understanding that that's what we do. So if I'm talking to somebody in any scenario, like let me give you my favorite one, which is about, you know, when people are ill. This is what I love this because this happens every day. And if you listen to this and then go and listen to any conversation where somebody's ill, it goes a little bit like this. Hey, how are you today? Oh, do you know what? I'm not great. I've got a cold. So one of two things will happen now in general. We'll either say, oh, yeah, there's loads of that going around. Or we'll go, oh, yeah, I had that cold last week.
Yeah.
Oh, it took me ages to get over it. Oh, it was awful. Really awful. And suddenly we've taken the conversation away from this person that was talking about being ill and we made it all about us. So in any negotiation, in any conversation, this goes for whether I'm talking to somebody who's in a life or death scenario or whether I'm talking to somebody I'm talking to in the street who's having a tough time. You have to, one of my mentors always said this to me. He said, Nick, you have to earn the right and you have to make sure that it's okay for the other person. So it might be that I will share a story. It might be that I will offer an opinion, but I will wait until I'm asked about that. So somebody might say to me, say there's a siege going on. They didn't mean this to happen. They've come home from the pub. They've had a few pints. They've had a big row with their partner. Their neighbours heard the big row, called police. Police are knocking on the door. And now they've gone, the police are here. I don't want to get into trouble. So they're going, like, you're not coming in. You're not coming in. I'm not letting anybody out. And then gradually as the alcohol wears off and they start to have a more logical conversation, they get to that place where they're like maybe even a little bit embarrassed about what's happened. Or then they're not feeling great about themselves. So they might say, what do you think I should do? And now, because they've asked me that question, I've earned that right to answer that question.
Rather than telling them, you mean? Like
rather than telling them, yeah. Rather than saying, well, you need to come out, mate. Because why would you listen to me? You don't even know me. But if you ask me the question, or it might be that you're having a conversation. I've got a 16-year-old in my life, and I'm very mindful, and I use her as a practice because it challenges every part of my being, especially if she's being an emotional person that triggers my own emotions, or perhaps she's challenging an opinion or pushing the boundaries. So I consciously make an effort to practice. And then if she says to me, what's your opinion? I'll give it to her, but I won't give her my opinion straight off the bat. Like, because, and we do that all the time. We go, you should do this, you should do that. And what's happens when we do that is we look at it from our own perspective. I remember sitting on the train going into London. It was a young girl opposite me, about 14, 15, and I think she was with her dad. I'm going to assume she was with her dad. And they were having a conversation. It sounded like they were going to an audition. And she was super excited, and she was sharing it with her dad, and they were talking about it. And then he said this. He said, this is what you should do when you get on stage. As soon as he said that, she put her earphones in and just smiled at him. And she wasn't listening to him at all. She'd gone, switched off, because he'd taken that support conversation and made it all about his opinion. And we do it all the time. So yeah,
especially with kids, it's one of them, isn't it? Don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, rather than say, do you think that's the right thing to do, or why are you doing that? You know, don't half push you. But that's an interesting one. What the dad perhaps should have said is, what are you going to do when you get there, right? Rather than say, do this.
Yeah
No, it's an interesting one.
Or even, have you considered? Have you considered doing this?
Yeah. I remember that.
Yeah.
That's a good one. I was going to ask, what's your proudest moment? So what situation have you been in where you thought, that's a really good result, that?
Yeah. There are so many. Honestly, the great thing about being a negotiator is you work with like-minded people who are there, or they're always there for the right reasons, because they want to make a difference in someone's life or they want to save a life. And there's always a great team around you. So on our little unit of six, we did a lot of work. We were super busy. You know, I was away between 6 to 7 months of the year in different countries, either working or training other people. We had lots of incidents that were going on. But I joined the team when ISIS were taking over Syria. So there was a lot of British nationals being kidnapped and very sadly killed. So there was a lot of work there with families and just trying to and talking through things, as well as lots of work in London in general anyway, because it's super busy. There's like a kidnap a week in London. So our little team were really busy. One of the proudest moments is we won the Metropolitan Police Team of the Year Award, which was phenomenal to be recognised for that. Another of my proudest moments was becoming the UK Director of Training and being responsible for training lots of other negotiators. Incredibly proud of that. I'm proud of every single incident that we ever went to, because I always knew that whatever the outcome, we would have done our best to make a difference on that day. There are lots of incidents that stick in my mind that I'm super, super proud of. There's one where, it's in the book, and it's about a couple of people being kidnapped in Nigeria. And it was like, it's called 36 hours, but it was the fastest 36 hours, most intense 36 hours of my life, whereby we were having to negotiate through a private security company in another country in different time zones. So I'm really proud of how we worked as a team around that and what that looked like. And we got a phenomenal result and got those people back, which was great. Yeah, I mean, I was just really proud to be a negotiator.
It seems like a rewarding job.
Really
rewarding. It's so fascinating to me. Do people ever get the backup, though? You know, when you're speaking to someone, I imagine there's probably people who think, hang on a minute, you're a negotiator. You're not going to almost like manipulate me, because that's a strong word. I appreciate that. But that's almost what a pessimist would look at your job as being, right? Do you ever get people that get the backup and think, outright, I'm not talking to you? Similar to that first guy, I suppose.
Yeah, lots of people won't talk to you, but not because they think they're going to manipulate you. And it's really interesting, isn't it? Because I would say, we're not manipulating, we're influencing. You know, and when you look up the dictionary definitions, manipulation is around getting somebody to do something which benefits you and not necessarily them, whereas influence and persuasion is getting somebody to do something that will hopefully benefit both. And we used to have this conversation all the time, because and it's really interesting, because nobody wants to be manipulated. But actually, if I'm telling you to step away from the edge of the building, it's because I don't want you to die. So I am manipulating you to doing something that I want you to do. Hopefully I'm moving towards influence and persuasion, because actually for me, and it's again about beliefs, for me that's the right thing. But actually for the person there, it might not be the right thing. Who am I to say? But we give them choice. So I've had lots of people who don't want to talk, maybe because they're actually trying to make that decision in their head at that time. As do I want to live or die? And also, I've had people that don't want to talk because they know the end result is they're going to be arrested. So they'll often not talk, because they think if they don't talk, then it will all just go away. But eventually they'll go, I need to talk to somebody here. So you are as good as anybody else. I've never had somebody go, oh, you're a negotiator. I'm not, I know what you're doing. I never had that. So most people, when you speak to them, are in crisis. And it's interesting, because we've had negotiators talk to other negotiators who have been in crisis. And even though you know what they're doing, because they're so good at what they do, they're still able to build that relationship and have a proper conversation with somebody.
That's interesting. What's the most challenging... So the 36 hours is probably up there, right, in Nigeria?
Oh, yeah.
Let's frame it a different way then. What's the most concerned that you've been that if I don't get this right, something catastrophic could happen?
Definitely 36 hours.
Okay.
Most definitely. Because there were so many elements to that. And we knew at one stage that they were being, so they were kidnapped by criminals, but we knew at one stage they were walking towards the terrorist area where they were going to sell them on. So that was a really critical time.
Okay.
But then every single suicidal intervention I've ever been part of, most of them happen at height. And you are literally having a conversation with somebody who is making a decision about whether they're going to live or die that day.
How does that make you feel?
Yeah. At the time, I was trying to describe this the other day to somebody. At the time, you just get on with it. You're nervous before you go. Of course you are, because you're running for every scenario in your head. But once you're there, you just become part of the scenario. And you just get into the heart of it, and you're so focused and you're so present with the other person, time just disappears and flies by, and you don't even think about your own feelings. It's only probably afterwards, depending on what's happened, that you will sit down and go, okay, how was that? And we used to debrief everything. Thankfully, we're 90-95% successful most of the time. I've only had one person who jumped in front of me and I hadn't even started the conversation really with them. And that, you know, that's horrific to watch. But thankfully, I haven't had many where we haven't been successful.
This next question, I'm going to be really careful how I frame it, and I hope it comes across in the right way. It might be relevant more to those who are just starting out. So you mentioned in that first negotiation, your mindset was all about me, 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 without realizing it consciously. If you're attending a situation where someone's threatening to take their own life, would there ever be a part of you that thinks, if I get this wrong and they end up succeeding, that could hinder my career in a way? I don't know if that makes sense, but you mentioned that when you're talking to them, you're so focused on saving that person's life for that person. Is there ever a niggling feeling at the back that thinks, if I save them, I'm going to look really good, but if they end up doing it, that's going to reflect bad on me? Does that ever enter your mind?
No. I think I appreciate what you're saying. So one of the questions I was asked as a firearms officer was, how will you feel if you have to shoot somebody? And one of the questions I was asked as a negotiator is, how will you feel if you lose somebody? I now realize the answer to those both of those questions is, I have no idea. Because I don't think you do. I think you can say what you think, A, you should say, you know, but also B, we all have an idea of how we'll be in a crisis or how we'll deal with it. And a lot of it's down to training. A lot of it's down to your support network. A lot of it's down to how you manage stress and pressure and all those sorts of things. Honestly, I don't think until it's happened to you that you actually know how you're going to react.
How do you take that burden home with you, though? Like, if, for example, that one scenario where you've lost someone and you have your debrief, and it's unfortunately part of the job at times. It can always happen as an outcome. But how do you then go home and live your normal life knowing that that's happened? Do you have to compartmentalize things? Do you have outlets that you turn to de-stress? What's the process at home?
Yeah, so definitely put it in a little box somewhere at the back of your brain and hope that the box never gets opened. I love being in the gym. That is my go-to. When I was much younger, it was cigarettes and alcohol. I'll be honest with you. You know, I'd go home and have a large scotch and smoke a packet of fags. But when I became a negotiator, thankfully, I had moved forward with that stage in life. So I was no longer really a drinker or a smoker. And my biggest outlet is definitely physical exercise of some sort. I never would talk about it at home. So my partner is still a police officer, and we very rarely talk about, I call it the darkness in the book, but very rarely talk about the darkness in the book within the home environment. And we used to have mandatory referral to occupational health. So if there was something very traumatic, or that you'd lost somebody or were involved in a team that had something had happened, or you were suffering, then there was occupational health. And also, we know from research with negotiation and negotiators especially, that quite a lot of negotiators are very emotionally intelligent, and they suffer from something called emotional transfer. So when they're talking to somebody, they'll take on the emotions of the other person. So we know that happens. And so we had a plan in place a few years before I left policing. You'd fill in a questionnaire, and then they would psychologically assess you. And if they felt that you needed some extra help, they would give you that. So, yeah.
So 2018, you retired from policing.
Yeah.
And then 2022, you're awarded a British Empire Medal.
Yeah.
That must have been a proud moment.
Incredibly proud. Really proud moment. Yeah. Still can't quite believe it. And this is again where conversations are amazing. I didn't know what I was going to do. And perhaps some of your listeners can relate to this. You know, you've been in one particular role or one particular career for a long time. It kind of becomes your identity and who you are. So if anybody ever asked me, I was always like Nick the police officer or Nick the negotiator. And after 31 years, because I'd grown up in policing, you know, I started when I was 18. And I was like, well, who am I? Who am I now? What's going to happen for the rest of my life? And I live in a little village, and I had my car at the local village garage being serviced. It was a Skoda dealership at one stage, and it was being serviced, and the guy that had owned it for 48 years was getting on a bit, and his daughter used to run the office part of it. She said, Nick, what are you going to do? And I was like, Melissa, I've got no idea. I said, you know, I've retrained as a personal trainer. I love fitness and health. I love all that. I've got a performance coaching qualification, and you know, I've been a hostage and crisis negotiator, but I don't know how that all fits together. And she said, gosh, she said, I used to be a personal trainer. And I was like, oh, wow, that's amazing. She said, your dad asked me to come and help him here, and I've been here for the last 10 years. But as he's kind of wound up the car showroom side of things, I've suggested to him that we have a gym here. Jokingly, I said, that would be amazing because it's just down the road, and that would be awesome for me, selfishly, of course. I said, put a coffee shop on the side of it, because I've lived and worked in London and everything revolves around coffee. And that would be awesome. And she said, oh, it's for sale. I was like, okay, great. So I went home and I said to my other half, oh, garage is for sale. And the next thing, it was like, we'll buy it. And I was like, well, what am I going to do with the garage? And so we converted the car showroom and put a gym and a coffee shop in there and kept the garage workshop. And I suddenly realized that all my conversations I were having with customers and team and work people, that, you know, trades people that were coming, all the conversations I were having, I was using my hostage and crisis negotiation skills. I thought, oh, that's interesting. So I set up a little business that teaches all the lessons I've learned about hostage and crisis negotiation to other people, especially in leadership. And we were just getting up and running. Of course, COVID hit. So we had to close the gym, mandatory. So we took that online. And we had to close the garage workshop because nobody needed their car fixing, because everybody was getting like 4 months to a gallon at the time. Nobody was driving anywhere. So I didn't have any work coming in. And they pushed all the MOTs. I don't know if you remember, from April onwards, they pushed all the MOTs forward by 6 months. So nobody needed an MOT.
Yeah.
So I had to furlough my staff there. And then with the coffee shop, and I'm so grateful for actually, you know, policing instilled this in me, but I was like, I'm not closing the coffee shop. I can't walk away from a crisis that we're having. There's people in this community that really need us to be here. And I knew that, because when we'd first opened the coffee shop, it was all a bit, why on earth have we got one in the village? And then gradually it became a real central focal point for people to come and meet. So we went to takeaway, and we kind of became like a Meals on Wheels place. So we were getting food out to people who really needed it. We had families of older generation in the village phoning us up and asking us to deliver food. And then we'd go and stand on the doorstep and have a half hour conversation with them, you know, just to check in and make sure they were okay. We matched people that wanted to do something with people that needed people to do something for them. So we came like a central hub. We set up a community kindness social enterprise, and it was amazing. Ran free classes online, gym wise for the community, and just threw ourselves into helping the community as much as possible. And somebody very kindly put my name forward in a medal, and in the Queen's last New Year's Day's honours list in 2022. I was incredibly proud to receive a British Empire Medal for meritorious service to my community during the pandemic. So,
wow, so cool. Well, I'm going to pinpoint everyone again to your book. So as a reminder, it's called Crisis, True Stories of My Life as a Hostage Negotiator. I'll put a link in the description of this episode so people can go and give it a read. It's at the minute, I don't know if you know this, but on Amazon, it's the number one most gifted book in the gang violence subgenre. Yeah.
There you go.
Cool, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
So it's definitely in demand. So go out and get a copy of Crisis. Nikki, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Really been lovely speaking to you. And for everyone else, I will see you next week.